Yes, Roxy.
Yes, I was thinking, you always said how you saw the World Trade Center being attacked from a distance. And I was thinking,
yes,
New York is called the Big Apple. And that's like the second fall of the,
yes, the
hologram.
Yeah.
The Big Apple and
the New York into the skyline.
Yeah, and Ian says New York is the Babylon that the Bible is referring to. New York existed back there in the perception of whoever those guys were in 700 BC in Babylon.
Yes, and all the things he was saying about Ground Zero being like a portal and actually the towers are like a big 11.
Yes.
So
okay,
this is the type of symbology that I will see when I'm reading The Wake or Ulysses.
That, right. Okay. I'm on City Island. That's a great phrase, City Island. And we're looking at the big 11. But I'm the other 11, me and Carolyn are the other 11 that don't get knocked out.
Right.
But there was something about 93 I wanted to mention. The the first media Xenocrony that we're talking about that anybody recognized, other than my own subjectivity noticing things, was Jim Patterson, Carolyn's website designer, the guy who made the Howonic site back in 2009, but 16 years earlier, in 1993, we had just gotten to New York City, Jim Patterson calls up, and he was a fan of our Mike and Dyer and I, but we hadn't talked that much, a little bit here and there, but he calls up on the blue and says, Bob, and leaves a voicemail. He's saying, there's this new show called The X-Files. It's incredible. Right there in mainstream media, they're doing all your stuff that you had on CKLM 10 years ago or 8 years ago. He was floored by this Xenocrity. And that was the first time I ever really had anybody else tell me they noticed it. But I didn't know about that one. I didn't know about The X-Files. And then to see he does that in 93, and he's still involved. So when Andrew Crystal gave his talk the other day that I was banned from because I was going to phone in on Michael Edmonds' phone and listen to it. Who was in the audience for it? John Oswald, who Jim Patterson was the manager for and occasionally still is, and Sandy Perlman, two heavy guys in the Android meme mainstream and alternative. John Oswald is the fringe avant-garde art world with Michael Snow. Sandy Perlman was manager of The Clash and the Blue Oyster Cult and all kinds of things. What are these two guys doing? Where do these artists who are older now, retirement age, what do? They become a McLuhan fellow. They're both, you know, getting paid to be associated with the McLuhan program. They have to go the Bob route. I was talking about what their art was going to do 30 years ago, and they don't do it, so then they end up having to be a student or a professor of it, a bad professors. But the point is that Andrew gives his talk, and all his knowledge is based on what he learned from me, plus his own unique New Zealand experience, but basically he's doing me, his PhD is, and then he has John Oswald, who Jim is who works for, as well as working for me. And there's other overlaps with John Oswald. He did, you know, the Plunder Phonics. You know about that, Brian?
Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, definitely. John Oswald was another overlap. Earlier this month, the Flowers of Hell played a show, a free show at Big Dundas Square.
Right.
And one of the thing that happened before us, or a couple acts before us, was John Oswald presenting he wrote a piece for 1,000 violins.
Yeah.
So they tried to get 1,000 string instruments into the Dundas Square to play it for real without backing tracks. And they didn't have 1,000, but they had over 300 at least, and it sounded incredible. So it's like John Oswald's performance, and then my band played, you know, an hour later.
Ah, there's the connection.
That happened earlier this month.
Right, and you, I didn't fully understand it. There was something going on at that tavern, some weird technical something, people acting out robotic behavior. I don't know what, I can't remember what it was. You posted about that.
No, that was a different thing, the thing about that there was a hypnotic bar.
Yeah, they get hypnotized, right.
Yeah, instead of getting drunk, they get hypnotized into being intoxicated.
Now, did you watch that?
I heard about it, and I was half planning on maybe trying to go check it out, but it was too last minute, and I couldn't.
I wasn't
going to go get hypnotized. I just thought I might want to look.
Right, so John Oswald, so Andrew Chris.
Last week
ahead.
I saw a video also in which the people dancing on the video are hypnotized. And,
okay, there, that fits right in. I was puzzling about that. So Andrew Crystal tells Michael Edmonds, who passes on to me, because Michael met with Andrew, that Andrew interviewed John Oswald, and Oswald mentioned, I came up because Oswald is a friend of Stang's.
Oh, of course. That makes sense.
Yeah, because, you know, Oswald's a super editor. Stang's a good editor, so they might share an interest in something, you know.
Well, and it makes sense that John Oswald in Negative Land would be, like, in contact, at least, back in the day.
Yeah, because he also made his reputation by digitizing Michael Jackson stuff in the late 80s, right?
Yeah.
And then the Jackson estate forced him to destroy all the CDs. But as a result of that, the Grateful Dead asked him to digitize their catalog. And then he just went on. He eventually got the Order of Canada. That's the award McLuhan got. John Oswald. And so when I met him in a gallery, an art gallery in New York in 2007 or 2008, just before I came here, I was hooked up with Michael Snow, who's Canada's greatest artist, modern artist in many ways. John Oswald played in Michael Snow's band, and they're a bad version of Zappa, so to speak. But anyway.
Wait a minute. You mean CCMC?
Yeah.
John Oswald was in CCMC?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I saw CCMC play once, and Paul Dutton was also involved in that concert.
Paul Dutton, is he, who's Paul Dutton?
He was one of the Four Horsemen, and he was the vocalist for CCMC.
Oh, okay, right. There's another Paul that I'm thinking of that might overlap, but I don't think that's Dutton. Anyways, I think John Oswald is more recently because this week when I saw them in New York, I got together with Michael Snow. They were playing at a popular club in New York City, and Oswald was playing with them. So Oswald may be a more recent member of that band, CCM. Mm-hmm. What are you saying, CCM?
CCMC.
All right. So at the gallery, I end up talking to his partner, wife, whatever she is, Holly somebody. We have a long, long talk. Oh, no. Before, at the gallery, I see John Oswald, so I go over and I say something about his art. And then he says something, but he's not being very responsive. And I thought, well, maybe I should tell him how I know him. But before he sort of picked up, I was going to ask him, say, draw some attention to me. And he says, I know who you are. He says it like that. I know who you are. And he says, okay, you know who I am. So then he walks away. He doesn't want to talk. So then I end up in a long conversation with his partner, Holly. She's a ballet dance teacher or something up at York, and I'd heard of her before. So she proceeds to tell me in detail everything about how they met and how they courted, you know, years ago down in L.A. or something. All these incredible personal details. And so I get to the bottom of his personal life. Not that I tried to, but she just told me everything. And then,
exactly. It's not like you tried to.
Yeah.
As soon as you start saying that, I'm watching it in, like, subgenius, like, anger-colored glasses the whole time.
Yeah,
like, what a fucking creep. Like, John Oswald is like, I know who you are, and I don't want to talk to you. It's like, well, I'm going to talk to your wife and your personal details. Like, but, of course, it's not you trying, even. You don't even have to try to be.
I wasn't even trying. So after an hour and a half of us going into this biography, and it's useful that I find out because I'm the only one who's fucking remembering everything about who did what for the last 50 years, so I'm supposed to know this stuff. So it gets filled in later. So John comes over after an hour and a half and sort of respectfully says, Holly, could I speak to you in a minute? Like, he didn't interrupt. He didn't tell her to stop talking. He just asked her, could I have a minute? And so eventually we stopped, and she went over to talk to him. And then the next day I had a whole encounter with Michael Snow, which led to him wanting to do something with me. But then his son went on the Internet back in Toronto, discovered the Stang version of me, and freaked out Michael Snow. And that didn't lead anywhere.
Right.
You know, they took the Stang angle. Because Michael Snow created an image, the walking woman in the 60s, that went around the world like the Dobbs head. He was a precursor of that.
Right.
You look him up, Michael Snow, S-N-O-W. So, anyways, I spent a lot of time talking with Michael one night, and then the next couple days later I met with he and his wife, who was the original art bureaucrat that was creating this idea of doing talks in the 70s. What'd you say? Did you say something? Maybe he said, I'll be back in a minute. Did you anybody hear what he said?
No.
Okay. Are you there, Brian?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So anyways, this Peggy, what's her name, was the original cultural bureaucrat that I was talking about, Caroline Schneeman, hours ago, where the professors get to bring the artists in into the university classrooms, and they have content for their jobs, and the artist has nothing. Well, I got talking about that, saying, I know the original person who started this trend. I'm talking to Michael Snow about it. And I go on and on about it. And then I say, you know who it is? He goes, no, who are you talking about? I said, I'm talking about your wife, Peggy. She started it. Back in the 70s, I saw it at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, and he laughed at that. But he then went told on about his issue and how he encountered Derrida, and Derrida was afraid of him and this and that. So he told me some stories about that, like de Kerckhoff was telling us 2 hours ago about Derrida. So so what's the point here? The point is you got John Oswald, Jim Patterson, Andrew Crystal, Sandy Perlman. So when I was in California last October. I was driving. I had heard about Sandy Perlman being at the Coach House, and I wanted to get in touch with him because we're trying to get me and Scott Woods are trying to get Sandy to get in touch with Richard Meltzer so Meltzer can hear my analysis of Meltzer's book, The Aesthetics of Rock, which I did in detail. A very good series on rock criticism that if Lester Bangs and the rest of them were alive, they would have to deal with. So. I'm trying to get in touch with Sandy Perlman, and then I'm driving down to San Jose, and a cab, you know, $100, $150 cab ride, and we're zooming down there. All of a sudden, I see a university that is the university I know that Perlman is teaching at or had taught at. So I get the cab driver to pull over, go over to the university, and keep the meter going. I jump out and run around administration for 20 minutes trying to find if Perlman was teaching there right then. And it might have been very close to right now, a year ago, because I couldn't find him. He wasn't there. They didn't have any record of him. So then, here it is a year later, I find he's teaching at the McLuhan Coach House. So I emailed the head of the program, Dominique, and said, how much it costs to be a part of this course? And when are they? So right now I'm negotiating with somebody, maybe you, Brian, if you get a live phone, I'll pay for it. You go into the course, and I have the cell phone. I can hear it,
right.
And I can fucking upgrade whatever he's trying to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Sandy Perlman and John Oswald, which relates to what we're talking about right now.
Well, and it makes perfect sense that, like, it's just so funny. I can just picture so clearly how both convincing and completely stupid the subgeniuses like warning these people off from you would be, you know, that it would be totally convincing. They'd be like, they'd look him up, they'd be like, oh no, this guy's like a notorious, like, if you're friendly with him at all, you'll become like a head on his wall. He'll claim that you're achievements rub off on him somehow. I know you just got to get away from this guy at all. Like, he'll make it like some political thing or whatever. And it's like, I'm sure they've gotten very good at this point at saying that kind of thing while not noticing they're doing that kind of thing while they're saying that.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, and that you're just an eager, sincere, very gregarious guy. who naturally falls into those situations and whose people's fucking wives like better.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're talking about Oswald and that guy, Perlman, because it was something I want to. The punchline is that they're involved this week. It's what I'm concerned about, and it somehow comes up. I can't remember how we get onto this, but it really. Oh, I don't know what it. 93.
Crystal thing. Oh, right.
Something to do with 93, maybe. But the it was my interaction with Michael Snow. Just before I came to Maui, like I finally met, I had bumped into him at different music places, but never talked to him in detail. But now I'm spending a few days with him just before I come to Maui, just before I'm going to lock down the greatest artist, scientist in the history of humanity. So I finally meet the great Canadian artist. You know what I mean? It's the last guy to talk to.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, and also it makes perfect sense that, you know, despite being warned off of you or something, they can't avoid you completely,
right.
Which is why they end up at the, like, well, I mean, clearly no one can respect themselves while getting into this ion shit. But if this guy was, like, if Bob actually had something going on before the ion stuff, and this guy is, like, translates that into McLuhanese well and isn't all about ion, then we'll go listen to him. Whatever Bob may have had to say in the past.
Right, exactly. You see, people, how Brian can sort of articulate this complexity? Are you getting that, Roxy? Well, maybe she's... Oh, you're still here.
No, I was muted.
Yeah, you're getting what Brian's very good at talking this.
Many people don't really listen, and they think they just repeat McLuhan like most scholars do. But you're going
they don't
much
hear
more
me. They don't hear me being excited and reapplying McLuhan all the time, making interesting commentary. They don't hear the reapplication and revigoration of it.
Yeah.
Yes, and the deeper understanding of many aspects of McLuhan that most people don't see.
They haven't a clue
that,
about.
For example, Joyce and McLuhan were actually against technology, and most people think it's all the contrary.
Right.
Because they saw how people were hypnotized by it.
They were ionic. Ionic is not against technology, but it says there's a whole part of your being that you should develop as an insurance against you being fucking smeared in the technological thing that's coming. And so the artist usually is, the great artists are questioning science and technology. But it's an ionic agenda, ultimately, these guys are doing, because finally ion gives us the means to do it.
Yes, and the understanding that, for example, nature is technology. The planet, it's all human creation. It's all
so
extension.
We talked about the Star of Bethlehem is man-made. Well, a later version would be here. Your whole reality you can make as a human being. I mean, maybe if you die and you don't live here, but your great-great-great-great-grandchildren will be born in a world where they'll be given, okay, this is how you're going to make your whole hologram. You know what I mean? You have real freedom of choice. And then
I'm thinking how... the Genesis starts in the garden. The garden is supposed to be human-created nature.
Right.
Human organism.
Right, that's right. Good point. McLuhan said that. That was one of the first insights you got from McLuhan. You were shocked at him saying gardens were man-made.
Yeah.
It's the garden of I-beam.
Right. I-D, what?
I-beam.
That's right, right. On the chart, now, was it you, Roxy, or Brian, who was amazed at the Garden of Technology? It was you, Roxy, right?
Yeah.
That was one of your first.
We tend to think, for example, here where I live, there is like a cult of a guy called Amos Comenius. He was like the first pedagogue, and they have a garden based on his ideas. And
right.
One side is like the wild garden, the nature, and the other side is the human plant garden, because they say his idea was that he was actually talking about the world order, and he was a big influence of the Rose Croix, the Rosicrucians. And he saw how humans have this big responsibility because they affect nature, the creation of God, like they have the same level of influence. But actually, the wild side of the garden is also part of the garden, so it's also garden.
Right. How do you say his name? You discovered him. Comenius or something?
Comenius. Amos Comenius.
Right, and you,
he was born
you,
in France.
You looked at some of his writings and thought he was talking like McLuhan, 500 years ago.
Well, I see a lot of similarities, and I thought there was much more written on these aspects of Comenius and McLuhan, but I haven't found much. Because
he wrote the
first pedagogic book, the first book that was used
for schooling, for education.
For schooling. And he was the first who said everybody has to go to school, not only the aristocrats and,
right.
and be programmed in a way.
Right. Now, that's C-O-M-E-N-I-U-S, Comenius.
Yeah.
Right. Now we got Sarah. We got Big Sarah here. If you've been listening, Sarah, you must love this conversation.
Yes, it's good. I'm calling in to tell you how much I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's your kind of mind labyrinth. You like this kind of stuff.
I have the same kind of I don't know.
Okay, tell us about. I didn't
anomalies.
Fully get it. Right, I didn't fully get it. Tell us, what did you discover about Carpenter and the museum and the artifact? That was pretty interesting. I didn't really get what you were saying. Now, this is McLuhan's main colleague, Ted Carpenter.
Yeah, at the Manil in Houston, they just started a new exhibit of Ted's Eskimo artifacts. And, he wrote a lot about how museums lay things out in such a way as and not get
the wrong way.
The wrong way. And
yeah.
It just felt like that to me. I don't know why.
Now,
it just felt like that.
Now, remember, his wife is a Demoniel. He's
very part
of the establishment art world because he's married to the Houston Demoniel family. So Ted Carpenter will get into the old-fashioned art world. Because he told me he couldn't take McLuhan's later technology as art and globally modulated by computer. He couldn't go that way. He stayed with the Don Thiel aesthetic level. And now he's forced to be presented in a gallery that distorts all his life's work.
I know. When they first displayed his stuff at the museum, I think they took that exhibit down maybe 2010 or something. It was called Upside Down, and they put a false floor in. It was a much bigger space, and it was round, and it was all white. So you felt like you were in this white, like he describes the Arctic or
the
whatever. Just the Eskimo. So that must have been nice. I would have liked to have seen that, but it would have been maybe a little bit. But he curated that himself, and it's probably a pretty expensive thing to do. He might have brought Harley Parker in on that, too.
No, Harley died. But, Harley's been dead for years.
Oh, but I mean, but that...
Are you talking about are you talking about a few years ago or many years ago?
Well, no, maybe they put that in about 2008. Was he dead in 2008?
Harley Parker was, and
Ted died.
Ted died a few years later. Like, he's not around to do this one that you're talking about.
No, he has there's a curator that did it.
Right. But that makes sense that he would have done it properly if he did it, if he organized it.
Yeah. I think the first exhibit that he curated was done well. I would have liked to have seen that.
Right. So you were in Houston lately.
Yeah, yeah. But what I sent you was there was another room that's kind of a permanent exhibit that Ted curated for in honor of his mother-in-law, Dominique. And it's just one room off of the Surrealist Gallery. So they have lots of different Surrealist artists. And they have a couple of Picassos I had never even seen before. Pretty interesting. But off this one room called Witnesses, it's some stuff that Ted collected, and then maybe the museum also gathered some of it. But it's all things owned by Surrealists, things that they kept around their house, and it was some really freaky shit. But it was a pretty cool little room. It's just he liked the whole idea. It was a lot of things that were tribal art that they collected around the world, different artists, and he loved just the juxtaposition of different tribal art and different cultures all together.
Ooh, Ted, Ted did?
Yeah, Ted loved that, seeing that.
Well, that's what he wrote his book on.
Yeah.
He wrote his book on The Pattern That Connects, which shows all the art comes from the same places, which is not a popular anthropological theory. It's been discredited, but Ted goes with the old-fashioned thing, and that's what he would like, how the archetypal ground to those different tribal artifacts of different areas.
Yeah, and it's a small room, and it's just crammed full of stuff, and it's really, really good.
Now, let's bring in how Bob looks at this. I bring in facts that enlivens what we're talking about. We're talking about the people and the Institute that made the art history of the last 40 years, 50 years, that your kids, if you send them to college, will learn, or even in high school.
Yeah.
This is orchestrated out of the Demeneal family. And Mr. Demeneal, who died in 73, was accused and interviewed by the Warren Commission as one of the guys who killed Kennedy.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding.
Right. The Ted Carpenter's father-in-law, Ted didn't marry Adelaide until, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago or something, but he'd been with her since the late 60s. But in 73, Ted would have to listen to his girlfriend Adelaide's anxiety about her father being accused of being involved with the Kennedy. No, sorry, that would be in 63, 64 in the Warren Commission. So who knows if Adelaide told Ted about her own family history in reference to the assassination, because he would be part of the Texas elite. So the school of thought thinks that something coming out around the Hunt brothers or something out of Texas killed Kennedy, that may have tied him in. I am not an expert in reading up on Cecil B. DeMille, what he said. But he married the Schlumberger, Dominique, that you
Dominique
said Ted didn't think.
Schlumberger,
and they go back a couple hundred years, and they had a big, important oil bit, drill bit technology in the oil industry.
Right.
So anyways, Fred Hughes, who they like this guy, this young guy, Fred Hughes. He was an art critic guy coming up, graduate of art school maybe or something. There's a lot about him in the Andy Warhol book that I was telling you about that Carolyn read called Holy Terror. But Fred Hughes, a representative of the Demeneal Mafia, art mafia, is Warhol's manager. He's the one that keeps Warhol going. So there comes back to Ted Carpenter again. So it's really interesting how these two great artists on a new level, dealing with media art in the 50s and 60s, one falls back into Gutenberg art history, and McCloum forges forward. And they're at the crux of the aesthetics argument about art, yet very closely involved with political things like the Kennedy assassination by association.
Well, and yeah, that is some fantastic stuff, and it really is important because the whole, especially after Ted Carpenter died, and I had a chance to read some of What a Blow That Phantom Gave Me, and it really brought it home that a big part of McLuhan's image of what the idea that people had of what McLuhan's wisdom was really was Carpenter.
Right.
You look at a portrait of, like, McLuhan's face in the kind of virtual icon, and a whole quarter of it is just straight-up Carpenter anecdotes about, when you give uncontacted tribes a video camera, they They swoop it around. They don't hold it in one fixed position, you know, things like that. Those kind of anthropological anecdotes became such a huge part of McLuhan's thing.
That his arsenal.
Yeah.
That's right. Carpenter.
Yeah, right.
Carpenter, privately to Kirchhoff, told me when he talked to Carpenter and interviewed him just before McLuhan died and he was doing his thing for CBC, Carpenter went on and on angrily about how he was McLuhan and McLuhan wasn't. That McLuhan ripped off stuff. He totally disgusted Derek, but I had heard.
I'm not surprised, though. Like,
right.
Looking back on it from 2011, I was like, wow, he was half of McLuhan.
Right. And I knew Carpenter talked to him in the 90s, and he told me the same line that he gave Derek. So if we go, Sarah complained about whatever they featured to Carpenter because she's thinking of the fantastic Carpenter we played. So we go to McLuhan Audios. If they have it annotated, which one is Ted Carpenter's talk? It is an awesome speech. He's the guy saying the wild stuff, the aesthetically appealing stuff of the late 60s that avant-garde artists would like. You've heard that, right?
I sent an email. I can't find an email for the curator. His name is Sean Cooney, and
right.
I was going to send him an email saying with a link to those two classroom talks that he did, the Columbia ones, I think they were in 1967, and I attached those to the email. I don't know. I just sent them to the general email. I haven't gotten a response yet. I don't know if they'll forward.
What are you sending? The Carpenter talk to Sean?
Yeah, there's
okay.
Two classroom talks that I found in the archive there. And I said, the exhibit is nice, but listen to these great talks that Ted gave at Columbia about this exact collection you displayed.
That's awesome. I will... Give me some what they are. I'll call them up and supplement what you
said.